Thank you, Brian. As Rob mentioned, we would like to highlight several new and existing resources that are available to USA staff and our partners. Sorry about that. We are pleased to announce the release of a new briefing book on Fishing for the Future, the Importance of Wild Fisheries to Food Security and Nutrition. This briefing book presents evidence of the importance of wild fisheries in global development, from food security, nutrition, livelihoods, poverty reduction, the role of women, and climate adaptation. This report covers information from Rob's wonderful introduction, plus much more. The briefer also showcases several successful USAID fisheries programs in Bangladesh, Ghana, and the Philippines. And I've noticed that several people have asked if we're talking about marine or freshwater. We're talking about both in terms of fisheries. The approaches are similar to both marine and freshwater, with some slight differences, but basically the same approaches. The briefing book also highlights the importance of fisheries in several key Feed the Future countries. And so what's included in the briefing book are some key statistics showing, for example, what the percent of each country that is land or marine-based, nutrition and food security statistics such as the percentage of population experiencing food insecurity or stunting in children under 5, and percentage of dietary animal protein from fish in their diet. The link to this resource is included in AgriLinks website to this webinar and can also be found on USAID's Development Experience Clearinghouse, or the DEC, and the Biodiversity Conservation Gateway portal. In addition, we produced several in-depth country profiles on the importance of wild fisheries to local food security in these same 9 Feed the Future countries. The country profiles cover a range of topics as to how wild fisheries relate to broader development objectives and include some of the topics that you see here on the slide. The briefing book and country profiles were produced by the Food Security Integration Working Group, and we'll continue to move forward to look at ways that we can do a more integrated approach to food security development. In addition, several years ago, we produced a technical guide called Sustainable Fishing Responsible Aquaculture, which is still very relevant today. This guide provides basic information on how to design programs to reform wild fisheries, also called capture fisheries, and aquaculture or fish farming to ensure sound and effective development. Certainly, as Rob pointed out, in the face of food insecurity, global climate change, and increasing population imperatives, that it's imperative that development programs help to maintain ecosystem resilience and the multiple goods and services that they provide, such as fish, by taking a more integrated approach to food security and development. We cannot afford to neglect global fisheries and expect aquaculture to fill that void. Global food security will not be achieved without reversing the decline of fisheries, restoring fisheries productivity, and moving towards more environmentally friendly and responsible aquaculture as well. And as Rob mentioned, this concept of secure tenure is important for both small-scale farmers and small-scale fishers, and I think the presentations by RARE and also Ghana also emphasize this important role. So we are developing and piloting resources to help implement secure tenure for small-scale fishers, as recommended by the FAO Voluntary Guidelines for Securing Small-Scale Fisheries. And securing marine and coastal tenure will also be critical for climate adaptations as we see rising sea levels and migrations of people. One reference is on small-scale fisheries and marine tenure. It's a pretty comprehensive source book on good practices and emerging themes. The other is a shorter primer called Looking to the Sea to Support Development Objectives. The primer has job aids or assessment tools to help design marine programs. We have several pilots planned around marine tenure to test these assessment tools in the field. And I need to give a shout out to my colleague Stephen Brooks in our land tenure office, who is leading these efforts, as well as the Tenure and Global Climate Change Program, which is helping us in this effort. So the presentations today covered the importance of wild fisheries to food security, nutrition, and livelihoods, with an emphasis on small-scale fisheries, and certainly has highlighted some of the approaches being taken to restore and enhance productivity in fisheries. Just a reminder that next week, on April 27th, please join us for an Ask Ag online chat, where we take a deeper dive into impact investing in wild fisheries. Now, at this time, we'd like to go to some of the questions that you have been sending to us, and please take this time to add other questions into the chat box. One of the questions that's been posed was talking about what is the role of women in wild fisheries, and maybe we could have both Brett and our Ghana colleagues respond to that.
Hello, this is Justice from Ghana. When it comes to the role of women, basically in Ghana, women play a significant role, first of all, in the processing of fish. And so they kind of have the capabilities to control what happens within the sector, in the sense that sometimes they are even the financiers of this industry. They are also very much involved in the marketing and the value chain of fish. So they have a very significant role. I can speak more in terms of Ghana, but I know the dynamics may be different for other countries. But for Ghana, women have a strong role when it comes to wild fisheries.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zachary Bakke. I'm going to help moderate some of the Q&A here. I'm the Senior Knowledge Management Advisor for the Bureau for Food Security. Question is, it's related to value chains, but what are some specific challenges with small-scale fishery value chains? What approaches have been considered to tackle them?
Basically, in Ghana, the value chain for fisheries is very informal, and so financing is one of the key issues that needs to be looked at. So basically, it's a very informal process, and that is usually led by women in terms of processing and marketing and making it available to the consumers. For Ghana specifically, you could have fish that is processed, be it dried or smoked, that goes all the way to the northern region in terms of Ghana and to other West African countries. However, there's limited funding in terms of these activities. And also one of the issues is the hygienic nature by which some of these products are handled. So there is a need to improve the market channels and develop them further, and then provide women with best processing systems to help them to make these available, and also to improve the product itself, because very little value is added to the product. So as much as possible, we want to improve the product to make it more valuable so that fisher folks can earn more money from that, and then they may not have to, you know, harvest more fish. There's also the issue of post-harvest losses and handling, and that needs to be looked at. So basically, in summary, I would say that these are some of the challenges. Our project in Ghana is actually looking at some of the processing. We are trying to help improve the fish smoking systems. We are introducing more efficient stoves for fish processing. We are also working with a lot of the women group organizations to let them understand the skills that they need to have to improve the products so that they can earn more from such products. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. One of our speakers, Brett, had some technical difficulties. He's rejoined the room. And so, Brett, do you want me to repeat the question about challenges around value chains for small fisheries?
Yeah, if you can, that would be great. I hope you can hear me.
Yep. Got to scroll down past the question. There it is. Sorry. So around value chain programs, what are some specific challenges with small-scale fishery value chains? What approaches have been considered to tackle them?
So this is a very big question that everybody faces as soon as you address what we think is the most basic question, which is that of tenure. It's tough to start working on value chains in any way without rule of law, without enforcement, licensing, registration, without a secure tenure. It seems in many ways like without some of those basic assurances, it's pretty difficult to bring to bear any potential market reform. So let's assume first that those things are in place. Then in many ways it's like the world of smallholder agriculture, in which case, for such disaggregated local units, there's the need to organize around cooperatives. There's a need to improve the value of the product, whether in fisheries it's through drying, through cold storage. There are marketing opportunities teaming up with, you know, several sites in the Philippines. We're joining forces with sustainable fish middlemen whose procurement guidelines are being merged with the Fish Forever production guidelines, in a sense. And that way, this buyer, this aggregator, is able to market a sustainably caught fish with a premium price, garnering story about the benefits of the sustainable approach in these communities. So whether it's a value-added technology or aggregation and marketing schemes, or delivering to domestic markets, most often fishery reform by NGOs in our arena, at least, has focused on premium commodities for export under some kind of certification like MSC. It's not as common, but hopefully in the coming decade it will be much more common for these emerging marketplaces to be able to boost the value of these products in country, so that they don't need to be exported. So that's there's a variety of opportunities, and it seems like that. I was talking with a friend of mine, Willie Foote from Root Capital, who's a leader in the smallholder agriculture finance arena. And we talked about the possibility at some point of organizing, I think he coined the term, a farmers to fishers exchange, where all of you folks in the arena of smallholder ag could transfer your past 25 years of learning to small-scale fisheries. There's a big opportunity there. Many of the same things, same lessons apply.
Thank you, Brett. This is Zachary again. So going on to our next question, this is for all the presenters. So Luis Ramos has asked, do you have specific experiences in this, in ways that we can learn from around holistic landscapes and seascape approaches? What specific advice would you give in implementing landscape seascape approaches?
So this is Brett. I'd be happy to at least think out loud about that. Depends on how you're defining, what's the size of the seascape. But essentially, Luis, we've been working increasingly on a pilot basis in the heart of the Philippines in a place called Tanyon Strait, where we're seeing increased adoption by municipal presidents and local fishers of this turf reserve concept. And increasingly, it's expanding outward from villages managing their own small MPAs, which has traditionally been coastal resource management default practice in the Philippines, to managing now turfs around those MPAs. And over time, there's greater interest in expanding both the size of the MPAs and, of course, the size of the turfs. Essentially, because of decentralization in the Philippines, each municipality manages its own waters. So one could say that the municipal waters up to 15 kilometers out from the coast in the Philippines are a turf. They just have not been managed as such. So there's a big opportunity to build networks of municipal turfs, and we have begun to do that. What's required is a great deal of community participation, a collaboration between local authorities, local fishers, a variety of stakeholders, and then a team of steely fisheries ecologists and designers to help essentially chart out and map priority resource conservation areas, priority fishery recovery areas, building on the maps, the mental maps that fishers have of their own waters, to achieve both fish recovery, biodiversity conservation practices, and then, of course, equity. Not without its challenges, but over the course of the next, by the end of 2016, we hope to have 20 such examples just in these first couple of years from Indonesia and the Philippines.
Thank you, Brett. Do any of our other presenters have comments? For additional kind of context, we said put in that in Central America, one of the problems is that the number of artisanal fishermen is growing, this probably implies that to protect coastal resources and oceans, a landscape approach looking upstream is needed to provide additional opportunities to the people so that the people will refrain from fishing from rights-based and no-take zone mechanisms. Has RARE considered a more holistic landscape seascape approach? Are there experiences to be learned from?
So we have, I wouldn't say that would answer your question satisfactorily, because about a multi-generational land and sea strategy, because just in this case, we've only been at this for a few years. I would say in the Western Pacific, in Palau and Ponape, we've been working on what is essentially a terrestrial and marine joint strategy, working, you know, with a similar model of turfs and reserves and then watershed protection upstream. But the populations are much smaller than what I imagine Luis is dealing with in certain coasts in Central America. So I don't believe we've cracked that code yet. We certainly have some ideas, but no.
Thank you, Brett. Do any of our other speakers have comments?
Yeah, I would like to say a little bit about that in terms of the work in Ghana. So with USAID Ghana, we designed an integrated fisheries and coastal management project, where we have one project looking at the seascape and another project looking at the landscape. As you can understand, the landscape is very important to make sure that the seascape is also doing well in terms of mangroves and in terms of estuaries. But again, the issue of livelihoods, because of the significant decline of fisheries, it's important to look at alternative livelihoods for fishermen. So our seascape program is looking at, is looking at working with fishermen and other farmers to introduce alternative livelihood mechanisms as well as some behavior change activities. We are also looking at improving the saving culture of fishermen and farmers. So we've introduced what we call as the village savings and loan program. So that gives, you know, help farmers and fishermen to kind of save something for the future and for periods where they are in need, when they are not getting enough cash from their livelihood. And this has really shown some promising figures at this point. And there's a story where, you know, one farmer who would actually go into a coastal forest to, you know, hunt illegally, because he was able to save some money through the village savings and loan scheme, he would not do that again, you know. And that alone has really helped in terms of looking at the issues of the wild fisheries and then the landscape issues. So there are many examples to give for Ghana, but for now I'll say just a few of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice, and thank you, Brett, for your comments. So for the next question, we had a few questions about co-management and the role of government. So what are the presenters' experiences in ensuring that adequate government participation in the government in the governance of fishing management?
This is Brett. I'd say that's an absolutely critical question. And so while RARE and his partners are working at the grassroots level with local fishers throughout five different countries now, we're also working hand in hand with the Ministry of Fisheries, Ministry of Environment, and local municipalities. So, you know, form follows function in many ways, and each country manages its fisheries differently. In some cases, like Belize, which is a small country, there's a national fisheries office, which is part of the Ministry of Environment, and the fisheries officer there is the one who issues the licenses, so that it's a federal license. In the case of the Philippines, because of decentralization, local municipal presidents or mayors have essentially the jurisdiction over their nearshore waters up to 15 kilometers off the coast. So it's a different government relation, different system. In each of these cases, though, there need to be provisions at the national, sometimes subnational, and certainly local level for ways of securing marine tenure and escalation protocols for enforcement, such as in the case of the Philippines, where the LGU or local government unit essentially deputizes local fishing groups to enforce their own local waters. There has to be an escalation process when they, in fact, encounter illegal fishers. And so there's legal systems that need to be put into place if they don't already exist. So that support locally and nationally is essential to create the kind of security that would enable any fisherman to trust the system enough to work within a turf and reserve approach.
All right. Thank you, Brett. Do we have comments from any of our other presenters? Okay. If not, we'll go on to the next question. We have Nina Haveri has a question for Brian. She has heard that the voluntary guidelines on the responsible governance of tenure are being promoted, implemented in the fishery sector in Ghana. Do you have experience with this in your USAID project working on this? This is also probably a question for Justice, too.
Hello, this is Justice. Brian is not here, so I would want to take that question. But if you don't mind repeating it so that I can be clear on it.
Okay, Justice. The person asking the question has heard that the voluntary guidelines on the responsible governance of tenure are being promoted, implemented in the fisheries sector in Ghana. And she was wondering if Brian had experience with this in his project or has been involved with it.
So basically, I'm not too sure we have that voluntary system here in Ghana. However, what our project is trying to do as much as possible is to kind of give a voluntary compliance to some of the illegal fishing activities so that we educate the fishermen in terms of some of the illegal things that they are doing and the need to have an ecosystem understanding of the impact of these activities on the marine fisheries. And by and large, they're beginning to understand that their actions is contributing to the significant decline of the marine fisheries catch in Ghana. And they're beginning to understand and appreciate the need to be involved in the collaborative management of the resources. So we are working with both government, we are working with communities, we are working with the regulatory agencies to help to understand and to let everybody be on board and appreciate the need to have a collaborative management of the resources. So, for example, we've been supporting and giving trainings to the marine police, we've been giving some trainings to the judges and prosecutors. We've been giving trainings to local communities to support self-compliance and voluntary compliance. So we've been doing quite a number of things on that front. But specifically to the guidance she or he may be referring, I'm not too sure about that.
Zachary, this is Brett. I wondered to add to Justice's comments whether this person might also have been referring to the FAO voluntary guidelines for securing small-scale fisheries. This is a major effort, major publication, and the work of thousands of people in multiple countries who have put together under the auspices of FAO some strong guidelines currently being adopted in a variety of countries that basically map very closely and I think would underscore many of the approaches that this webinar has covered. And I know that Rebecca Messner from FAO, I can see her on this chat group. She may be able to post that resource for folks if they don't have it.
Well, thank you, Brett, for that point to the resources. And Rebecca, if you have a chance, if you could share that resource in the chat box, that would be great. And Nina, if you're still online, if you want to provide a clarification, and perhaps Brett, you can answer that in the chat box as well. So we're coming to the end. We're going to ask one final question before we wrap up. We have another question about co-management from Peter Limbu. What examples do presenters have about how fisheries work to sustain their management costs, especially when it comes to fisheries co-management? Anyone want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, Zachary, do you mind really quickly just repeating that? I apologize. I was reading through several of the chat questions.
I know the chat box is always quite much more fascinating sometimes than the presentation. But
I do apologize.
So this one was about co-management, again, from Peter Limbu. And what examples do presenters have about how fisheries work to sustain their management costs, especially when it comes to fisheries co-management?
I think that's a really good question. I think we're going to know a lot more about that in a year or so, but with 50 of these turf reserves being set up in five countries across the world right now, it's clear that we're seeing local fishers begin to, in really meaningful ways, collaborate on the design and execution of their own enforcement schemes. Once tenure is secure and enforcement has begun, really the next logical step is serious focus on fisheries management. And that, of course, requires data and decision-making and education. But what's clear is there is a great deal of interest from the part of formerly reluctant fishers to get very deeply involved. And we're starting to see that in a number of these cases. I'd have to ask our team if there's anything, we'd be happy to get back to you on a specific case or an example of how they're establishing and then driving down management costs.
Thank you, Brett. And so this brings us to the end of today's Ag Sector Council. I thank everyone for participating and for a very active discussion in the chat section. And thank you to the presenters for excellent presentations. We appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge and experiences with us. Right now you have the polls up. This is kind of our end of the session evaluation. Please take a moment before you leave to fill out the polls, enter your experience. This is how we improve on our Ag Sector Councils going forward, and also find new ideas to bring you content for upcoming Ag Sector Councils. So we appreciate your participation. Any last comments from Barbara before we go?
Yes. I also want to thank everyone, both to the presenters and the audience. This has been very informative. And I want to thank our BFS colleagues for co-organizing this with us. And I want to remind everyone, and we hope to hear from you next week, we'll have a more in-depth discussion into impact investing in the fisheries sector. Please go to the AgriLinks event page for more information on that. And as Zach just said, please take a moment to fill out these polls. So thanks to everyone.